This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books Network podcast. I'm Benjamin Phillips. I'll be your host today. Joining me is, well, a baby asleep on my chest, who hopefully you will not hear throughout the recording. But who you will hear from is Dr. Kyle Gervais, Dr. Randy Pogorzelski, and PhD candidate Dr. Sarah Graham-Shinesi, who have joined us today to discuss their new work in the Brill series on Lucan and Flavian Epic. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks. Good to be here, Benjamin.
Thank you. It was good to have you guys. Good to read your book and this bracing introduction to these poems and to the scholarship surrounding them over the last, coming on 100 years now since kind of C.S. Lewis first heralding, hey, you should actually read these guys back in the day. Tell us about this project and how it got started, if you could.
Kyle, do you want to start us off?
I will start us off because I think I started this off, actually. I was asked to write this book in the grand tradition of academia. Someone more senior to me was asked to write it first and didn't have time for it and said, but maybe Kyle will do it. And I said, actually, that does sound like a really cool project, but I don't want to do it on my own because Lucan and Flavian Epic is a large topic. And my specialty is Statius in particular, but Randy Pogorzelski down the hallway from me at Western has some brilliant thoughts on Lucan and Silas in particular. And so we kind of started on the project together, and then a little way former PhD, MA student of ours, now PhD, Sarah. We brought her on board first as a research assistant, and then she was doing such good work on Valerius in particular that we said, hey, do you want to be a co-author? And that's kind of how the gang all got together and the project got going.
Yeah, very good. Congratulations on getting a co-author title before the doctorate. That's a dream for jumping into the job market.
Thank you. Yeah, it's definitely an amazing opportunity. And working with Kyle and Randy is always a great time.
So. Yeah, very good. So this grouping of poets, the successor poets after Ovid, why, you mentioned in the beginning, they're not usually all grouped together or the subject of common study. Why have you guys chosen to lump these four?
Randy, you probably have some smart things to say about that.
I don't know about smart things, but I have things to say about this kind of issue. I mean, there are, I think, a couple of reasons why we are interested in this particular grouping. Some of them we talk about a little bit in the introduction to the book, and that is that, you know, when you think about the sort of the big time scale of Latin epic, there's a very tight grouping of these four epic poets whose work survives to us, Lucan and Valerius Flaccus and Statius and Silius Italicus. And there's a bit of space before Lucan, between Ovid and Lucan, and there's quite a lot of space after Silius Italicus and then the next Latin epic poet whose work comes down to us, Claudian. Mm-hmm. And so the first reason I think to group these together is that sort of just chronological set. Mm-hmm. That they are close together. I think it's also true that they have this this common thread in their reception histories, where Roman epic from the imperial period, post-Augustan Roman epic, that is these poems, these five poems or four epic poets, have a sort of shared history of being admired in antiquity and then at some point losing that admiration and being denigrated for a long time, and then in the late 20th and early 21st centuries being redeemed to be, you know, good poets. And so that common thread is something that encourages grouping the study of these poets and these poems together. It is also just a practical issue that, you know, Kyle mentioned that we got started on this project when someone from Brill approached him to work on the project, which means that as a practical consideration, we have the series of research perspectives in classical poetry to consider. And this was a sort of a space in that series where there was room for a book to sort of complete the coverage or fill out the coverage that series works on. So there's a sort of practical consideration of what's needed for the series, as well as a more academic or intellectual consideration of the tight chronological grouping and the common reception histories of these poems.
Yeah, very good. So speaking of these poems, we here at the New Books Network, as we've discussed, we kind of have two potential audiences, one of people who are invested in these poems already and looking for the next scholarship on it. And some people, I imagine, who are clicking on this because they see epic, they've read the Aeneid, maybe they have Ovid on their shelves and they want to hear about the rest. So if you guys could just quickly introduce to us who these poets are and what their poems are, just beginning with Lucan being the first in time, Dr. Pogorzelski.
Sure, yeah. So as Kyle mentioned, I wrote the first draft of our chapter on Lucan. I do want to emphasize that the whole book was a collaborative project, and you know, we have all worked on every part. But it is true that I think Kyle brought me onto the project in part because I have some expertise and I've done some work before on historical epic, that is Lucan and Silius Italicus in this period of Roman epic poetry. So it makes sense for me to talk a little bit about Lucan. He was a poet of the Neronian period. He was a nephew of Seneca the younger. And he was sort of in the high circles of power when Seneca was an advisor to Nero. He was raised very near the court with Nero, and was very similar in age to Nero. They were friends and they were in the same sort of writing group together. At some point, the biographical tradition tells us that relationship went sour, but for a long time, Lucan was the sort of, you know, friend and court poet of the Neronian period. He was extraordinarily prolific. He wrote all kinds of stuff. We only have his epic poem that survives, his poem that's sometimes called Pharsalia, sometimes called the Bellum Civile, or a poem on the civil war between Caesar and Pompey. It's a poem that is both in the tradition of Roman historical epic, that is, it's an epic poem that's not on a mythological topic, but a poem about historical events. It also is worth contextualizing it in the larger epic. So I think one of the great sort of themes in scholarship on Lucan's poem is that it is a response to Virgil's Aeneid. It is very much post-Virgilian. Some scholars have called it an anti-Aeneid. So if the Aeneid is a poem that is largely about the Augustan project and has lots to say, if the Aeneid is overtly positive and possibly covertly negative about the Augustan project, Lucan's poem is kind of the other way. It is a poem that casts Caesar as a tyrant and a villain and is in many ways overtly negative about Caesarism. And yet there are ways in which the poem is also subtly very positive about Caesar and the big charisma and power that he had. Mm-hmm. So Lucan was extraordinarily prolific and wrote lots of poetry. When things went wrong with his relationship with Nero, they went very wrong. He was implicated in the so-called Pisonian conspiracy to assassinate Nero and was made to commit suicide. He died quite young, but he left us this poem that is exuberant and sort of carries us away with its energy in the same way as the character Caesar sort of carries away the Roman world with his energy.
Right.
I could keep going forever, but I think maybe there are other authors who could use a little time as well.
There are, including a much less well-known one in Valerius Flaccus. Sarah,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I have nowhere near the amount to say as Randy does on that. Mostly because we just don't have it. So very little remains of Valerius Flaccus's biography. We just really don't know that much about who he was or who he was friends with, or all those things. Quintilian in the 90s, after Valerius dies, says, we've recently lost much in Valerius Flaccus. So he offers that little obituary. So we know that he had influence among influential Roman authors, but we don't have a lot more than that. And he pretty much disappears after that in terms of overt references that we have a lot of work on. But his epic, which is the only remaining text of his that we have, his epic, the Argonautica, is a retelling of Apollonius's Argonautica, the story of Jason and the Argonauts as they go on their journey for the Golden Fleece. And that epic is it has a lot more modeled on Virgil. Mm-hmm. It kind of follows in Virgil's footsteps a bit more. And it is often divided into a two-pronged epic structure, where the first half is a more positive and heroic progression of Jason's journey. And the second half is seen as a little bit more pessimistic or tragic, right. Almost. And that is reflected in both the structure of the narrative as well as Jason's own characterization. Right. That's I think what I have to.
Sorry.
Pardon?
Not terribly unlike the two divisions of the Aeneid, times can be cast as
precisely.
Right.
Precisely.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. And then, although Valerius's was lost right until the Renaissance, Statius stayed along for a long time, and some people might have met him in Dante already before this, but why don't you tell us about that, Dr. Gervais?
Yeah, exactly. If you know, if you're from outside of classics and you know a epic poet after Ovid, it might be Statius, you know, especially thanks to his cameo or fairly long cameo in Dante. He was kicking around right from the beginning. I personally think he's got the most fun stories. His Thebaid is about the sons of Oedipus, Oedipus who accidentally kills his father and marries his mother, and then things just keep going bad. His sons end up fighting to the death for their father's throne, and the Thebaid is the long story of that disastrous civil war at Thebes, and then the Achilleid, a much shorter poem. It's a fragmentary poem because it probably was cut off by Statius's death, is about the early days of Achilles' life, and in particular the episode of him cross-dressing on the island of Scyros. His mother hides him there from the Trojan War, and he cross-dresses there and falls in love with the king's daughter, and then he's eventually found out by Ulysses and Diomedes. We're doing biographies, right? So Statius, Publius Papinius Statius, but until for the Middle Ages, until 1417, you knew him as Papinius Statius Circulus, who was a teacher of rhetoric from Toulouse. And one of our themes in this book is the reception histories of these authors, and they almost all of them have sort of a moment in the Renaissance with Valerius and Silius. It's their rediscovery. With Statius, it is the rediscovery of a third set of poems he wrote, the Silvi, which are a lot of them are autobiographical, and that was when the modern or the post classical world learned that he was in fact not a French teacher of rhetoric, but a courtier of Domitian, a professional poet who spent a lot of time sucking up to Domitian and lived in Naples and was sort of bicultural in terms of Latin and Greece. And that was actually the beginning of the decline of Statius's reputation, because we are suspicious of people who fawn over emperors, and we are, for even less good reasons, suspicious of people who come from the south and the east. So there's an interesting sort of story about Statius's reception based on that. In terms of the epic themselves, I think people come for the myths because they're quite interesting, and they stay, at least for my money, for the intertextuality. So I think of all of these four poets, and I'm very biased, I love Statius, but of all of these four poets, he makes most skillful use of his predecessors. Certainly people like Virgil, Ovid, Lucan, which is why it's exciting that we can do this book with these authors together, but a whole range of Greek authors, other Latin authors. And one of the really exciting things about all of these authors is most of the models that they are working with still survive largely intact. And so we can see in detail sort of the skilled way they work with their models and change them and appropriate them and twist them and things like that. So that's kind of in a nutshell, I guess, what Statius is and his epics. Oh, and you are muted, Ben. Benjamin.
Oops, thank you. And the Thebaid, if I'm not mistaken, is the only one of these epics that survives in its entirety, right?
It is resolutely complete. Like the Ovid's Metamorphoses, it ends with an epilogue declaring that I have completed this poem. Mm-hmm. Declaring sort of worryingly that the emperor has read it and loved it. And the emperor in question is Domitian, who, like Nero, is one of the bad emperors. Right. But yeah, it is a rarity among ancient epics for being complete. And that's another interesting thing with this project, right? Because we're also dealing with very incomplete epics, Lucan, Valerius Flaccus, and the Achilleid, which breaks off in the middle of a book. So right. We get to see sort of different modes of writing, I guess.
Yeah.
If I can interrupt for a second, Silius's Punica is also apparently complete.
It is complete.
Yeah.
And it's also the longest, right?
Go ahead.
It is. It is quite long. And Yeah, I mean, I suppose I can take over and start talking about Silius. Some people like to say Silius Italicus, but you know, I prefer to anglicize it as Silius. The epic that we have written by Silius Italicus is the Punica. It's a historical epic on the Second Punic War, the war against Hannibal, and it is quite long. It is what 17 books, yeah. So that 17 is an odd number, and we've just been talking about the complete state of poems, and you might think, well, if it's 17 books, surely, you know, he was planning on writing some more, and that's probably incomplete. And you know, it when you have 17 books, you can struggle to divide a poem as we often divide epics into sort of groupings of three books or four books, or even to divide it in half between, you know, a first half and a second half. We've already talked about the Aeneid being divided into two halves, and Valerius's Argonautica sort of potentially being a poem of two halves, I think. One interesting point that has been made about 17 books is that it is the total number of books that Virgil wrote that survived. So if you add up the 12 books of the Aeneid and the 4 books of Georgics and the eclogues, you get 17 books. And Silius Italicus was reportedly a huge fan of Virgil. We can see that in his poetry and also in the biographical tradition that he was devoted to Virgil. So it's conceivable that's a reason for 17 books. But, you know, it doesn't show any obvious signs of incompletion. It comes to a satisfying conclusion. The final book is about the same length as the others. So it's I think a complete poem. Right, so we have been talking a little about biography of these authors. Silius Italicus was a Roman senator. He was, in fact, a consular, so he had been a consul. His political career was largely under Nero, and this didn't stop him from, you know, being a reasonable success in the Flavian period and writing this enormously long epic poem on the Second Punic War. Like all of our other authors, Silius makes good use of his predecessors. And I think this is a point that I want to emphasize, something that Kyle brought up, that these are poems for whom a lot of models and predecessors are still extant for us to see. The point has been made in the past that this period, the Neronian and Flavian periods, are the periods in which the Augustan period became classical, in which poets made use of the Augustan poets as real models. So unlike lots of other classical poetry, we can see exactly how these Neronian and Flavian poets are making use of their predecessors and receiving the work of earlier poets. And I think that's really interesting, and it's something that Silius does a lot. He had a reputation in antiquity for writing very allusive poetry. I think, however, that, you know, at least for me, the Silius's poetry is a sort of a pleasure to read, partly because, despite the fact that it is really allusive and makes good use of its predecessors, it is at least superficially really straightforward. It's kind of easy to understand what Silius is saying in a way that more mannerist poets, and I would put Statius in this category, are not super easy to understand. So, you know, Silius is, at least on the surface, very accessible in a way that someone like Statius or Valerius Flaccus, for that matter, is not that accessible. Now, often in Latin poetry, that kind of accessibility is an illusion. So we see that kind of thing in Lucan. I think a particularly famous example is Catullus, where it gives us the impression of being really open and spontaneous and everybody can understand exactly what's going on. But when you dig a little deeper, you see that Catullus is actually very sort of deliberate and careful and detailed in the way that he writes poetry. And there's a lot that you can dig into. And I think the same thing is true for Silius Italicus. I think as a way of introducing Silius and talking about the sort of overall shape of the book that we've written on Lucan and Flavian Epic, it's worth pointing out that Silius is, I think, the purest example of the kind of reception history that we think links these poems and poets. Silius, who was relatively highly regarded in antiquity, enough that his poetry survived, just barely, was lost for a long time, but, you know, did survive, was denigrated for a very long time as the worst of all Roman epic poets. And you can see this even up through the late 20th century, people talking about just how bad Silius's poetry is. And then, you know, last of all these poets in the 21st century, now we can see that people are saying, no, actually, Silius is really good and we should appreciate the merits of Silius. And so for us, I think it's an example of the reason why we wanted to sort of historicize and contextualize that history to try to understand what is it about these poems that made that sort of common story go along. Because I think, you know, for me at least, it was my thinking about Silius and my sort of earlier readings and work about Silius that helped me to see that this was an interesting area of focus for working on these poets.
Well, you've set up the transition beautifully. So thank you for summarizing all of these, but explain, there is this narrative of redemption. You know, as we mentioned earlier, and been mentioning throughout, you know, the 30s, Lewis is saying, read Lucan and Statius. You have your occasional oddball promoting them as well. But tell us about how these get picked up and in the age of the companion and everything. Now they're popular again.
So I might jump in on that. And I think, I mean, Lucan was quote unquote redeemed first. And it's kind of interesting that these have gone more or less in chronological order. Statius is the one I always like to talk about. And actually, one of the interesting things about working on this project with Randy in particular is he is very suspicious of these sort of redemption narratives and very interested in the reception, as an object of study in itself. I started working on Statius just kind of at the tail end of when scholars were really motivated by that narrative. And my supervisor, for instance, Bill Dominic, was one of the people in sort of really the first modern generation of redeeming Statius. And a lot of their work was really motivated and animated by saying, no, Statius, in fact, is not a bad author. Statius is a good author. Randy would therefore say, you know, kind of buying into that narrative, which is a narrative and not necessarily a real thing. But for all of these authors, I think as a function of being later than someone like Virgil, and as a function of more than one of them sort of saying with false modesty that they are not as good as someone like Virgil, and as a function of making obvious reuse of previous poetry that we have, all of this encouraged scholars to see them as coming late to the party, admitting they're not as good as their predecessors, and just sort of shamelessly copying their predecessors. And then I think you're talking there, Benjamin, but you're muted.
Go right ahead.
Sort of in the, well, really begin, like, you know, in the later part of the 20th century, but certainly towards the end of the 20th century, we talk about a confluence of a few different events, postmodern thinking, which is suspicious of things like canons and more open to things outside of, you know, maybe the Homeric Virgilian canon, new technologies that especially databases that allow you to search for textual similarities between poems allowed scholars to dramatically open up the number of potential elusive links between authors, mm-hmm. and just appreciate how incredibly rich the engagement of these later authors are with someone like Virgil. Right. And there's two other things. Oh, a bunch more people getting PhDs in classics than there were in earlier times. And therefore, you know, Virgilian studies or Ovidian studies or Homeric studies were getting crowded and people were sort of looking further afield. What was the last thing, Randy? You had four things.
It was that critical mass.
The
pressure to go to other poets, but kind of frameworks for being able to do so.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Work on earlier, more sort of poets more central to the canon gave, and especially for authors like Valerius Flaccus and Silius, who did not have a reception history at all until the modern period, there were just no tools in the toolbox to understand them. And so being able to borrow and adapt tools from scholarship on earlier authors, which mm-hmm. is sort of a pleasant parallel to the authors themselves, borrowing and adapting from earlier authors, all of that suddenly gave the tools and the impetus to start working on these poets more seriously and more deeply. And Randy in particular, I think, would emphasize that we did not therefore suddenly discover that these poets are good just aesthetically, whereas we used to think they're bad incorrectly, but we sort of discovered complexities and richness in them that allowed us to appreciate them in a deeper and more subtle level.
Yeah. All right, so you even say at one point in the introduction that they've become good because we need them to. Can you unpack that for us a little bit, Dr. Pogajowski?
Yeah, I mean, I can jump in and talk about this a little bit. I think, you know, when Kyle was just talking now about how having a sort of a theoretical model or approach that was developed for reading Virgil available mm-hmm. to adapt to read someone like Silius Italicus, who does not have the sort of history of people reading his poetry that Virgil does, is really helpful. And that reminds me of a story from when I was a graduate student, when I was first learning about Silius Italicus. And one of my classmates was saying, you know, I'm going to write a dissertation about Silius Italicus because almost nobody writes on Silius, so I can, you know, it'll be easy to find something original to say. Whereas if I was going to write about the Aeneid, there's a million people writing about Virgil, and, you know, how can I come up with anything that hasn't already been said before? You know, and the idea being that it's sort of easier to write something that is impactful and original about an author that doesn't get a lot of attention. For the same reason, someone might say, I want to write on Valerius Flaccus's Argonautica rather than on Statius's the Biad, you know, that there's sort of space. And I understand that, but I think that can be really difficult too. Sometimes it's easier to write about the Aeneid, as I wrote my dissertation about the Aeneid, because there's a big conversation to jump into. And because, you know, when you say something even slightly interesting about the Aeneid, other people are interested because the Aeneid is, you know, kind of a at least in classical circles these days, the Aeneid is a bigger deal than say, Silius's Punica. And so it can be really challenging to try to find a foothold in authors like Silius Italicus or Valerius Flaccus, and to a lesser extent Lucan and Statius. It can be challenging to find a foothold and something to work on. And this is part of the reason why I think. Sorry, go ahead.
I was saying no footnotes to get angry at and write about. Yeah.
No footnotes to get angry at, no arguments to stake a position in, nothing to jump into. And so I have always found it easier to write on the more covered and more talked about authors. And that, I think, is a demonstration of a point that reception studies as a field has made to us, which is that works become more readable the more they are read. There's more to say about something when other people have had lots to say about it before. And so it becomes possible for us in the 21st century to write about these authors as more of us are writing about these authors. It becomes easier and more interesting. It becomes easier to find publication venues. It becomes easier to have people think that something that you have to say about these authors is significant. It becomes easier to find interesting things to say about these authors because you can bounce off other people's ideas and you don't have to sort of come up with everything from the beginning. And so this is why I say that now in this moment, it's not that we can suddenly appreciate that these poets are good poets and these poems are good poems, so much as the fact of us turning to them and reading them and having a discussion with each other about these poems is what makes them readable, is what makes them interesting, it's what makes them good to work with.
And I can't resist jumping in because I just love the parallels between the scholarship and the authors themselves. I mean, something that until the sort of redemption of all of these authors, something that scholars were really fighting against is this impression that if you come into a crowded field, as Lucan and Statius and all of these people did, there's nothing left to say. The point that Randy has been making is that in the scholarship, it's exactly the opposite. The more crowded the field, the richer the conversations you can have, and modern studies on the intertextuality of these poems make exactly the same point. The fact that Statius and Lucan and all the others had so much coming before them allowed them to say so much more than if they had been writing in sort of a pristine state of writing in a vacuum.
We kind of stopped feeling the anxiety of influence for them. And
exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
So how has that sea change like borne out in the interpretation of these poems? Like, but what are some of the new interpretive questions that this has generated for these poems?
Oh boy, this is where we have the editing because I got to think for a second.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so one question I still don't think we've seen the end of is the old question of that was borrowed from Virgilian scholarship of pro and anti-imperial readings. That animated a lot of early scholarship. I think on all four of these authors. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of scholars that will say that's a pretty tired debate now, and let's open it up in different directions. One area that I find particularly exciting in all of the authors is the intersection between sociopolitical readings of the poems and literary readings of the poems. So some of the coolest interpretations I've seen are talking about things like how the Roman world had changed politically and culturally in the Neronian or the Flavian era compared to, say, the Augustan period, and how all of these poets sort of explore those changes in part by exploring their relationship with earlier authors. So, Statius might say that my Thebaid is sort of different than the Aeneid, both in a literary sense and in a sense that it's being written in a different socio-political milieu. So I've got others, I think. Randy, Sarah, jump in.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
I definitely want to give space to Sarah to say something about questions about Valerius Flaccus.
Yes.
But while she thinks about that, I may say some things. I despite the fact that I feel tempted to talk forever about Lucan, I actually think maybe talking about Silius is a little more interesting in this regard, just because the new directions are newer in Silius. So of course, as Kyle says, one of the first things that people do when they try to tackle a Roman epic poet is the question of whether the poet is supportive of the emperor or not. But I think that you know, it is true that scholarship on all these poets has sort of moved beyond that question, both in terms of more nuanced versions of political readings of the poems, but also more sort of just ways to appreciate these epics that are not explicitly political in that way. So one of the ways that people have recently approached Silius's poem is to talk about the issue of exemplarity, which is to say that the poem offers us a lot of figures who are both positive and negative models. And so in this poem about the war against Hannibal, Hannibal is a sort of interesting model. He is a kind of, you know, anti-hero, and sometimes Romans can be assimilated to Hannibal or divorced from Hannibal. There is a fight in the poem over the legacy of Hercules. Hannibal thinks that he is a new Hercules, but also Scipio thinks that he is a new Hercules. And the question of who gets to sort of to claim the inheritance of the past is a really interesting one for me. So much of authority and power relations and politics in the present is about who gets to tell the story of the past and who gets to claim the authority of the past. And one of the ways that Silius's poem does that is through these exemplary figures. So one of the first monographs in a long time on Silius's Punica was Ben Tipping's exemplary epic about exemplarity in the poem. And I think that's been really nuanced in interesting ways. So we talk about sort of the way that Silius uses the Virgilian model of this sort of dual inheritance or dual exemplarity, where two figures take over or compete for a model, or a later figure is sort of influenced by two different models. And this happens in Silius all the time. Another, I think, really interesting thing that people have argued recently about Silius is that Silius, and I associate this in particular with what Bob Cowan has called side shadowing, like foreshadowing, but side shadowing. Silius is, he seems to be really interested in what we might call, or what people these days call, counterfactual history. What would have happened if this hadn't been this way? If it hadn't been for Hannibal, would we have still had this war? If it hadn't been for, you know, Scipio, would things have come out the same way? And sort of exploring those alternative historical paths in a way that allows him to think about whether it's people or larger historical forces. I associate that sort of question with Tolstoy, you know, that if there hadn't been Napoleon, would things have come out the same way in that war? And Silius is interested in those questions too. And I think that's a really interesting way to read the poem. So there are these sort of new directions that are coming out in ways that both adapt older models of reading, like this question of exemplarity, and also develop sort of new ways of reading Roman poetry, like this issue of counterfactual history or side shadowing. And I just one last point that I would make about this is that I think it's super interesting to think about the question of civil war in the Punica, because, you know, this is a book on Lucan and Flavian epic. The title suggests that that we are interested in the relationship between the Flavian epic poets and their predecessor Lucan. We could characterize this these poets as the epic successors of Lucan. And so even though the Second Punic War is very much not a civil war, because, you know, it is against the Carthaginians, the great enemies, there are all kinds of ways in which the Punica characterizes that Second Punic War as a civil war and uses it to explore the sort of civil wars that Rome had experienced both leading up to and in the Flavian period. One of those is simply a program of allusions to Lucan, One that's really interesting to me is thinking about what it must be like for a reader in the Flavian period, where Carthage is a major Roman city and almost a sort of second Rome, to read about a war between Rome and Carthage as though Carthage were this great foreign enemy. And it very much isn't anymore. If the Punic Wars had been fought in the Flavian period, they would have been civil wars. And so reading this sort of foreign war as civil is something that I think is another interesting new direction in ways to read the Punica.
Fascinating.
So I've gathered a whole grab bag of future directions, but we've been threatening that Sarah was going to talk a bit.
Threatening, yes, indeed. yeah, I can talk about a couple of different directions that Valerian scholarship is going in. I think I mentioned, we talked in the chapter about, because intertextuality is now so much more a direction that is able to be taken, a lot more study has been turned to that, especially with new technology. So I think that the ability to use searches to determine when authors are directly using Valerius, it will increase the amount of work on intertextual reference in from Valerius. There's also a lot of the history of the scholarship on Valerius Flaccus, the focus was not on so much on socio-political discussions. It was more on trying to create a workable text that was valuable to study. For a long time, just coming up with a manuscript that wasn't super corrupted was a big focus. And so now that we kind of have we're kind of a little bit more past that textual criticism stage that was necessary to kind of cement the poet's voice in the first place, we're more able to look at what he was intending to do or what he ended up doing with that voice. And so there have been recently a lot more articles and discussions on whether or not it is a positive or negative engagement with the politics of the time. There are evaluations like Stover, who talks about the positivity of the narrative, whereas Bernstein says that it's impossible to create a positive interpretation of it. And then there are, of course, more balanced perspectives. And then I think that the direction that is going to be most beneficial, or at least that is seeing a lot more progress, is the discussions of Valerius's own reception. More bold interpretations of Valerius's, people seeing Valerius's influence elsewhere, include Kyle, who has identified in John of Garland a reference to Valerius Flaccus and stuff like that. So more reevaluation of previous texts to stop reinforcing that same narrative that, oh, Valerius just wasn't that important, his work wasn't studied that deeply. Reevaluating that notion is, I think, where we're headed for that.
Kind of sounds like Sarah was throwing things over to me. Can we keep talking about this, Benjamin, or do we need to move on? Yeah, so I mean, we've been talking in broad strokes about the reception as in sort of a bit of a theoretical register, right? You know, what does it mean for a poem to have a rich or a non-existent reception history? What are the various sort of unexpected factors that might lead to a poem's quote-unquote redemption? Can we be suspicious of the narrative? Things like that. For all of these poets, both the ones who we know were read and studied continuously, Lucan and Statius, and the ones who sort of disappeared, Silius and Valerius, there is a lot of just really basic work to be done on various moments of reception. And I think for Statius, for instance, there was just a book-length and incredibly rich article written purely on medieval commentaries on Statius's Thebaid, the vast majority of which almost no scholar has looked at all. And every one of which would repay attention, both from the perspective of medieval studies and from the perspective of the reception of Statius. Same story is true of Lucan. On the other hand, for authors like Silius and Valerius, I mean, we say they sort of disappeared, but all that means is, as far as we know, they weren't really being read, but there are sort of tantalizing moments where it looks like maybe a medieval author might be alluding to something in Valerius. Yeah, Sarah mentioned, so a book I wrote recently was on a 13th century poem about Ovid's Metamorphoses, which I am reasonably convinced contains an allusion to Valerius when Valerius, you know, quote unquote, had disappeared. But there is some evidence that there might have been a manuscript of Valerius kind of kicking around in the region at the time. And I think to some extent, these stories of non-existent reception can be self-reinforcing, because you say, okay, Valerius didn't exist at the time, Silius didn't exist at the time, let's not even look for evidence of their being read, when if there is evidence, it would be by way of an allusion that you might not notice, or something that's not somebody saying, hey, I've got a text of Silius in front of me that I am alluding to, right? So I think scholars getting a little bit more adventurous about looking both for the things that are clearly receptions of authors like Lucan and Statius, or possibly receptions. There's just a whole lot of unstudied material across several disciplines, from ancient studies to medieval studies to Renaissance studies to early modern studies. So yeah, that's a wide open area, I think, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I would just add that in general, in classical studies, I think reception studies is a sort of huge growth area with, you know, an increasingly good reputation. There was a time when if you wrote about the reception of a classical author in some post-classical period or some post-classical author, it might be hard to find a publication venue. It might be hard to get people to take you seriously as a classicist. But I think more and more, you know, classics departments are hiring people who are interested in reception studies. Classical publications are publishing articles on the receptions of classical authors, you know, and so we've in this book talked a lot about the receptions of these authors, as Kyle says, in sort of theoretical and very broad way. But some of the really interesting work that is being done on any of these authors is a much more detailed and focused kind of reception studies about particular pairings or the reception of particular authors in particular periods. You know, Kyle talked and Sarah mentioned briefly the reception of Valerius Flaccus in medieval literature. One of the really interesting books that I read in working on our book about Lucan was Edward Paylite's book on the reception of Lucan in 16th century England, which I thought was just fascinating work, and more of that stuff would be great.
Right.
And I'm going to do one more. Getting ready for this chat, I was reminding myself of when these poems were rediscovered, and I remembered that Poggio Bracciolini in 1416 or 1417 was up north of the Alps at a big debate about who should be pope, and he spent some free time looking for manuscripts in old monasteries, and he famously rediscovered Lucretius's poem. He less famously, at exactly the same time, rediscovered Valerius Flaccus, yeah, rediscovered Silius Italicus, rediscovered Statius's Silvi. Right. And that is a moment in the reception of three of these four authors that it was massively important, both obviously for the rediscovery of two of them and the precipitous change in the opinion about Statius. And as far as I know, nobody's really sat down and talked about, you know, what was that early Renaissance moment like for the field of Flavian studies, essentially.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like we have a lot more we could talk about, but hopefully to the scholars listening, that gives you plenty more ideas for new articles or books or venues of study. And if you are just a casual reader who's been enjoying this, I will be putting recommendations of translations gathered from this book in the show notes. So feel free to pick yourself up a copy. And if this interested you, in the next week or two, we'll be having Neil Bernstein on to talk about Claudian and his new translation of that poet and the next successor after these. Thank you all for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you
for having us.
Great.
And thank you everyone for listening. Have a good day.